I'm Connor Friedersdorf, a staff writer at The Atlantic Magazine.
Oh, and I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV, and I'm a guest on The Friedersdorf Show.
Yes, and one thing I wanted to talk to you about today, Bob, I've been making this case at The Atlantic for months now, saying, hey, liberals, hey, progressives, hey, Democrats, you used to care about all of this executive power stuff and all of this war on terror excesses and executive power excesses during the Bush administration. And I think that the case against what the Bush administration did was really powerful and really credible. And now the Obama administration has done a bunch of the same things. And yet the left is basically persuaded that he's the guy to back for re-election, that Romney would be even worse by their lights. And I want to make the case that there should be a protest vote, that the libertarians are a possible way to go, that, you know, the Green Party, for all I care, is a possible way to go. I think there has to be some way to hold Democratic presidents accountable on national security and civil liberty stuff, or else these issues are never going to go the way those of us who care about them think. And so I know that, you know, our politics are different, and you are probably more inclined in general to vote for Democrats than me. And so one thing I wanted to ask you maybe to kick things off is, what would it take for you to abandon the Democratic Party over these issues?
Well, I mean, first of all, you have to ask the fundamental question of how pragmatic you want to be. I mean, I think it's the feeling of some people that they would never do a protest vote per se if it decreased the chances of their candidate winning, right? I mean,
right.
I'm curious, do you accept the premise of people like me that Romney's foreign policy would be even worse than Obama's, his national security policy?
I certainly accept that it's a possibility. Yeah. I don't think it's clear, but I certainly think that it might be.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. I've been wondering this. I've been genuinely wondering, you know, given, you know, what an Etch-a-Sketch Romney is purported to be, whether it's possible that actually his national security strategy would be no worse. I mean, he's totally cozying up to the neocons, but, you know, once you're president, you need these people a little less than you do during the election, so who knows. But I do think that by my lights, he would be worse than Obama, although I am very unhappy with Obama's national security policy, you know, with the drone strikes and him having ramped up Afghanistan and everything. So if you ask me what would it take, I mean, first of all, it would take, I would have to be a little less confident that Romney will be even worse, because I'm sufficiently pragmatic. But I mean, maybe for the purposes of this conversation, I should forget about that part, right?
I guess another way to put it is, I'm no great fan of Mitt Romney, and I actually don't plan on voting for Romney. I'm almost certainly going to vote for Gary Johnson, the Libertarian nominee, knowing full well he has no chance of winning.
Mm-hmm.
I guess part of that is because I feel like I have to do something about these policies that I really hate. I just can't bring myself mm-hmm. to vote for someone who has violated civil liberties in the ways that Obama has, and who has presided over these drone strikes now in the way that he has. I'm open to other people taking mm-hmm. a different attitude and saying, you know, I want to be pragmatic for the purposes of the election, and Romney's no great prize, so I'm going to stick with Obama. But then the question becomes, so what is the mechanism by which these policies get reversed? And I don't really see another way to pressure Democratic presidents other than saying, if you do these things, we're not going to vote for you. It seems like a long-term strategy that maybe is a long shot, but I don't see any other way to go about it.
I mean, I feel almost disaffected enough to sign on to your campaign. Particularly these negotiations with Iran have really started to give me the feeling that, look, it's just one giant political establishment that stands in the way of progress. Democrat, Republican, it almost doesn't matter. I've really come to terms with the institutional obstacles in Washington to reaching a deal with Iran. And so I'm close to, you know, signing on to the revolution. I don't. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wonder whether a third party vote is effective because, you know, in 2000, the people who signed on to Nader in a comparable fashion, I think, you know, later came to be vilified actually by people like me once we saw what the Bush presidency was like. And, you know, it was clear that if those people had voted for Gore, Gore would be president.
Right.
So, in other words, it's not a certain thing by any means that a third party protest vote winds up, you know, strengthening, you know, being seen as a successful protest vote, you know.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. You know, another thing I wonder is, you said that there are institutional reasons for the policies that are being pursued by presidents from both parties, which I think is absolutely right. I think that there's also a public opinion reason, right? Although you and I are concerned about these things, a lot of Americans aren't particularly concerned about them, whether because they're focused on the economy or because they aren't particularly knowledgeable or interested in foreign policy or civil liberties or executive power. And it seems like even the people that do think about it a little bit often reflexively side with what you could call the hawkish position when it comes to foreign intervention, mm-hmm. the I don't even know what you would call it when it comes to executive power, I suppose the maximal presidential power. And I wonder why that is. I mean, one hypothesis that I'm kind of tentatively floating is that there's this psychological need to do something when you are afraid of something, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the analogy that I used this week was that, you know, you can imagine the doctor tells you you might be sick and we have this test that we can do and determine if you do have this disease, they could kill you. On the other hand, you could not do the test and take your chances. And actually, the chances of dying if you do the test are actually a little bit higher, but you'll know. I think in the world of medicine, people often do interventions that are actually a little bit more dangerous than doing nothing because they feel like they want to do something.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder if there's an analogous terrorism feeling that is leading Americans to do what I think are a lot of short-sighted things.
Well, I would tend more to think about how, you know, the human mind was designed by natural selection to deal specifically with human enemies. And I think, you know, once you define someone as I think we are built, our minds are built to be able to put certain people in the category of enemy, totally zero-sum relationship with them, and that evokes a set of responses toward them. And, you know, during natural selection, I doubt there were cases comparable to what I think we are faced with now, where, yes, Osama bin Laden is our enemy, but if we, in the most, you know, kind of simple-minded, most straightforward ways possible, attack him and his people, there is some danger of actually strengthening his movement, by increasing the amount of hatred of us. I don't think really during natural selection there was a comparable, very common and comparable dynamic. So I think part of it is we're fighting a war that's just subtler than the wars we were designed to fight. So once we put people in the camp of enemy, you know, the rest is almost history. I don't know. Does that make sense?
I don't know. I mean, it seems like on some level there's always been blowback, right? I mean, even if you have two tribes living reasonably close to one mm-hmm. another, it seems like blowback and how you treat people from the other group is always going to be a concern. You know, you can even think of in tribal societies that have retained their traditions, you can think of examples even now where, you know, you have a social norm of if you kill someone from the other village, you have to pay a certain amount of money. And this is the social mechanism that they have developed to avoid this cycle of blowback and violence that goes back and forth.
I do think
that there's something.
But see, that's the problem. We don't get the feedback right away.
That's true.
Blowback. It's the delay between us doing the stuff and the blowback that I think is new.
Yeah. Well, but even when the blowback comes, there is a powerful and almost baffling, certainly self-defeating, I would argue, resistance to recognizing it as blowback. I mean, the basic concept that, you know, you can think that the September 11th attacks were partly blowback without saying that they were in any way justified, right? And yet, to even suggest that they're blowback forces you to fall all over yourself saying, oh, but I'm not saying that they're justified, you know. That caveat has to be stuck in there immediately just to have a conversation about it. There's a very powerful resistance to the notion that anything that we ever did set in, put even a chain of events into motion that resulted in that attack.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't know if it's always been that way. But you know, I wish I knew more about the reaction that people had to Pearl Harbor, and I suppose that's really the only halfway analogous attack on the United States that you could even think about. But it just seems like, I don't know. I guess two things. One, it seems like there isn't even a willingness to confront what it seems to me are, you know, blowback is at least a plausible thesis, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it seems like anyone should admit at least that it's a plausible thesis, and people don't seem to want to grapple with that. And I guess the other thing that I would say is that even if you're right about this being one of the reasons that we target our enemies because we don't have this feedback loop, it still doesn't explain to me the way Americans are reacting to things like executive power, right? Where even if we agree that we're going to target people in another country with drone strikes, even if we agree that we're going to target American citizens with drone strikes, mm-hmm. which we're apparently doing, I don't see any reason why people are so averse to having an extra check in this process, right? In other words, it seems pretty obvious why it's dangerous to tell the president you can kill anyone you want on Earth, and you don't even have to go outside the executive branch to do it.
And it can be an American.
Right, and it can be an American, right? It seems like at least we should be able to agree, you have to run this by a panel of judges from the judicial branch, right? Are we really afraid, and I'm not saying that would satisfy all of the concerns of civil libertarians. I'm just saying, as an added check, it seems like an improvement on current policy in the sense that it avoids the problem of the president abusing this authority. And are we really worried that the federal judiciary that's been completely complacent after 9/11 is going to err on the side of not killing people that are actually in existential danger to us?
Yeah.
And yet there is not even people are very averse to even the smallest check, to even the smallest restraint put on the presidency.
Well, you know, I think the general principle is that if you can get people sufficiently scared, you can get them to sign on to almost anything. I mean, this is nothing compared to things people have signed on to out of fear either an enemy or fear of instability. You know, I mean, whole fascist movements rise and take control of countries. Or during World War II, you know, look at what we did with Japanese Americans. I mean, I just think, and that's why the people who favor these policies work hard to scare Americans. You know, that's why Fox News works hard to terrify Americans.
Well, yeah, I mean, so, you know, I've been reading up actually recently about people on the Pacific Coast during World War II. I'm actually doing this biography of one of the founders of SeaWorld who just happened to be in L.A. in college when when Pearl Harbor happened.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, people were really afraid of a Japanese invasion of the West Coast at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I mean, people are afraid of terrorism now. I suppose it's in the back of a lot of people's minds. And it's something that, you know, every once in a while, you know, say I'm on an airplane and I see a commotion at the back of the plane that before 9/11, I wouldn't have thought anything about it. And now in the back of my mind, maybe I think, mm-hmm. uh-oh, I better look back and check this out or something. You know, I think a lot of people feel that way. At the same time, people aren't behaving in other ways as if they're afraid of terrorism all the time. And by that, I mean, it isn't as if tourist numbers are down for people visiting New York City. It isn't as if people are mm-hmm. flying less to avoid terrorism. You know, in all these ways that if people were really afraid yeah. of a terrible terrorist attack happening, you would think that they would change their behavior in these other ways. And it doesn't really seem like people right. are that afraid on a day-to-day yeah. basis, and yet we point to fear as a reason why all of these policies are happening.
Yeah, but I mean, remember, from their point of view, these policies, most of them have almost no cost. What's it to them if some guy in Yemen gets killed? I mean, that's not, you know, it doesn't take much fear to get them to overlook that because they didn't care about guys in Yemen to begin with. They don't care, you know. And look, I'm not saying I'm better than them. I don't wake up in the morning worrying about which kid in Africa is starving to death, you know?
Right.
And that's just kind of the way people are. So I think it's a slightly more challenging question, you know, why when civil liberties at home seem to be compromised, there's not more resistance. But the compromises are not very pervasive and conspicuous to people, I think. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is something as a civil libertarian, I struggle with something like the TSA checkpoints, right? Because on one hand, if I could change one thing about civil liberties in the United States, it would not be the TSA checkpoints. I think that there are far more dangerous things that are happening and things that victimize innocents a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, the TSA checkpoints are something that bother me. And they're also something that are a very visible thing and one of the few things in the war on terror that affects a larger class of people than just, far away alleged radicals
right.
or than just Muslims, even in the United States. It's something that everybody has to go through. And it's a pretty visceral reminder of, wow, look at how much more intrusive the government is now
mm-hmm.
than they used to be. And look at how fast this has happened. And yet, even TSA, although there have been a few rounds of outrage in the media, doesn't seem really to bother the average American, certainly not enough to make it an election issue.
I think that's true. And although in general I think it's true that people don't walk around fearful of terrorism or fearful of something happening in their community, I think there are a number of people who when they get on a plane, they want to be really, really sure. And, you know, you can say, well, no plane has gone down since 9/11, but they will say, well, that's because the TSA has been on the case, you know. So I think there you're actually catching them at a point. I mean, I've heard people, when I've been exasperated in those checkout, in those lines, the TSA lines, people next to me say, happy to do it, you know, like
right.
Volunteer, that it's a sacrifice worth making. You know, people are very bad at assessing risk.
Yeah. Well, so I wonder what you think about what the outer limits are. I mean, is there anything that the government could do in the name of protecting us from terrorism that would cause a sufficient backlash, you know, because we have some pretty profound surveillance opportunities,
mm-hmm.
Especially with you know, police departments. There's this department in Texas I was writing about that's getting its own private drone through a Homeland Security grant
mm-hmm.
and is going to start it flying over this county north of Dallas that has, you know, basically zero chance of being victimized by a terrorist attack. But nevertheless, that's part of the justification that they cite for it. And I don't know. Are we just doomed then to
I guess one
funny thing is that these policies are never things that are clamored for, right? No one was clamoring for this policy no one was clamoring for the sheriff's department north of Dallas to get a drone.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that the sheriff decided he wanted to do and that Homeland Security officials decided that they would help out with. But once it happens, and once terrorism and being safe from terrorism is cited, then this kicks in as if people somehow always wanted it to be
right.
safe or something.
And I think the answer to your question about what we would not put up with is totally dependent on the perceived threat at the time. I mean, right now, I think, yes, if nothing changes, there's definitely things we wouldn't let the government get by with. I mean, I suspect that right now, if they even introduced explicit ethnic profiling at TSA checkpoints, there would be enough blowback to keep them from doing it. But if you had five, even little, successful terrorist attacks in a row in cities, even if they killed a total of no more than 100 people, if there was just, mm-hmm. A kind of a persistence about them, like in the course of 2 months, it just seemed like all of a sudden we were out of control, then I think that we're into a whole new world in terms of what the public mm-hmm. will accept. And that's what's scary.
Yeah.
Because it's actually not that hard to do a successful terrorist attack. In fact, you don't even have to be suicidal about it, And in fact, the fact that more or less nothing has happened since 9/11, okay, there was Fort Hood, there were things, but very, very little has happened in terms of actual terrorism on American soil, even though it's very easy to do. I think that tells you that, by and large, the Muslim population of America is not a problem, It's
right.
We're lucky, and we shouldn't be doing things that might change the attitude of Muslims in America, But anyway, that's kind of a hobby horse, but I think the answer is, I think I'm too cynical, but people, if they feel sufficiently threatened, will do almost anything.
So right now, while we're not sufficiently threatened, in other
right.
words, while we haven't had this series of terrorist attacks, we've actually gone a very long time. One confounding thing to me is that even back right after 9/11, when it was a lot less certain that we would go this long without a terrorist attack, or that we wouldn't suffer one even greater, relatively shortly on the heels of that one,
mm-hmm.
The Democratic Party was basically, I would say, divided between the people like Joe Lieberman, who kind of went along with the Bush administration's response and with the Patriot Act and all the rest. And maybe not divided, maybe even still the civil liberties people were a smaller group. But there was certainly a big pushback to things like indefinite detention and to things like torture and rendition and all the rest.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll hear people, especially conservatives, say now that Obama is in power. It's just pure partisan hypocrisy. That you see a lot of people who were furious at what the Bush administration did,
mm-hmm.
who were basically silent or even okay with even more worrisome precedents in some cases that the Obama administration is setting. I wonder if it is pure partisan. To call it pure partisan hackery, I think, implies a level of consciousness that I'm not sure is there. And what I would say is that part of the visceral reaction of liberals to the Bush administration had to do with Bush's manner. It had to do with this swaggering image of a guy trying to pretend to be a cowboy
mm-hmm.
and who wanted to go out and have a sort of John Bolton-like posture on the world
mm-hmm.
stage. Certainly that's not Obama.
Right.
Obama is someone who, in his speeches, although there are ways in which his administration exploits the fear of terrorism to amass power, at the same time, he isn't going out there and giving speeches like Dick Cheney was, where he's invoking the spectacle of a nuclear explosion in the United States,
right?
There are all sorts of things about his manner, about his way of speaking, about the words that he chooses that a liberal or someone with a cosmopolitan attitude is a lot more comfortable with. And I think that part of the reason why people on the left have gone along with him more are that just like people on the right use these cultural cues to decide who to be in solidarity with and who to agree with, people on the left do it just the same. And the cultural cues aren't the same, but the effect is the same. The effect is for people to abandon actually their convictions and the policies that they actually logically think should be put into place and just kind of side with the person who seems to echo the manner that they want things discussed with. Do you buy into that?
Somewhat, yeah. And the two things are kind of so closely related. In other words, just the image Bush protected and what you would actually think of his policy. So like when he said, at the very beginning of the Iraq insurgency, when he said, bring it on, you know, on the one hand, your average liberal is reacting against the cowboy swagger, but at the same time, you're thinking, that's really stupid, you know? That's a stupid thing to say, even politically stupid, you know? You've got the parents of kids who are dying in Iraq watching you, and you're like, bring it on? We like the heat? I mean, are you on drugs? So, you know, they're hard to... I would tend to say it is more partisan than cultural or whatever, however you want to describe your paradigm. I mean, there is some of both.
Right, yeah.
I would say, even to the extent that it's partisan, I agree with you that it's not always conscious by any means. Once you've decided what team you're on, the process by which you are more forgiving of the people on your team than the people on the other team is, I think, a largely unconscious process that people tend not to be very aware of.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say it's mainly partisan and not very consciously calculating. This process by which Democrats are so forgiving of Obama policies that are eerily reminiscent of Bush policies.
Right. You know, one person that I've criticized specifically is my old boss and friend Andrew Sullivan, who during the Bush years wrote very eloquently about a lot of these issues. And since Obama has taken office, what I see reading him is that day-to-day his blog is very committed to covering these issues and often does so, even when it reflects poorly on Obama. And in fact, he has said various things about Obama that are pretty extreme criticism. You know, for example, in one case, he basically said that Obama had committed war crimes and should be prosecuted for them, which is a whole lot farther than
Andrew said
anyone.
That?
He said, I'm not paraphrasing exactly, but he basically said, if the Geneva Convention means anything, Obama will eventually be, I don't know if he said prosecuted or arrested or something to that effect.
Well, Obama's known to read Andrew's blog, but maybe he missed that particular post.
And what I've noticed with Andrew, and I've actually written this post criticizing a couple other people too, Jonathan Chait and also David Remnick at the New Yorker. There are people who there are a lot of Democrats who, even when they criticize Obama in these issues in like a blog post or in a specific article about the issue itself, right? Then it comes time to write the sort of big think piece on the Obama presidency. And in the grand narrative, these things get lost. In the big picture narrative, Obama is still a transformational president who came into power at a time when he had all these challenges and he overcame all of these things. And we owe him thanks for this. And he's on the whole been a great president, right? And it seems to me that there's this disconnect, right, between because these are all people who claim to care a lot about these issues and think that they're very important. But then when it comes time to tell the big story of the Obama administration, they don't treat these issues as if they're very important. And this is, I guess, a larger frustration for me, where I want to tell people, I understand that you have these opinions about the economy and these opinions about, you know, gay marriage and abortion politics and all of the rest. It seems to me that it's national security stuff and war that the president really drives. Congress is basically going to drive domestic policy. In other words, in the long run, public opinion and whoever is in Congress and the direction it's really going to be going isn't going to change dramatically because of who's president. If you care about gay marriage, who the president is isn't really actually that huge a deal as far as advancing.
Yeah, you can argue agenda. That there was a lot of symbolic, significantly symbolic weight attached to Obama's, you know, shift in position on gay marriage. But I take your point about you know, presidents are more influential in the realm of foreign policy and national security. They're far from unconstrained by Congress, but they're much more important probably than. Well, I mean, I guess as you say that, I'm thinking about presidents who have very successfully, you know, Lyndon Johnson and, you know, who have really pushed domestic agendas. But I would say that with Obama, that's certainly the case. Yeah.
Right. And so yeah, I just think that there should be that foreign policy and national security and terrorism and all this stuff should be the major issue. Even in an election now, when you know people are understandably worried about the economy, and I don't fault the average American for worrying more about providing for their own family and whether they're going to keep their job and all of the rest,
right.
Than they do about faraway events. Whether you think that is smart or not, or moral or not, it's just human nature that people are going to do that. At the same time, I don't think that. Who we elect as president is, you know, whether it's Obama or Romney, is going to have a large predictable effect on whether these people get to keep their job.
No, but most Americans don't know that, I think. I mean, at least I don't think they have as subtle an understanding of, as you just conveyed. I mean, they think of the president as the person in charge. And they've never cared much about foreign policy except in special cases when there's a war that our people are getting killed in or there seems to be a clear and present danger, you know.
I don't know. I'm speculating here, but I would guess if you ask the average American how much power on a scale of 1 to 100 does the president have over the economy or does the president have over whether you get to keep your job or whether you'll be better off economically in the next 4 years or something – I would guess that people would cite a pretty low number. Maybe I'm wrong about
that. You may be right. If it's too low, then there's a lot of campaign money being misspent on ads. But you know, I don't know what the actual data are. I mean, the truth is, it may be that Congress doesn't have much power in that realm either. That right now we're in the grip of extremely large forces and. And it has more to do with things like whether Europe works its problems out.
Right. Yeah. Well, and there's also this way in which, you know, to the extent that there is some effect that Congress or the president has directly, you know, I pay pretty close attention to politics and have studied economics and all of the rest. And, you know, while I have my sort of weak opinions about what should be done, I'm not at all confident in my economic prescriptions. If you made me president tomorrow, there's a lot of policies that I would be confident that I could improve. The economy certainly is not one of them. And I don't know if Romney or Obama would be better when it comes to the economy. So I think that, and I think that probably the average voter doesn't know either and doesn't imagine that they know.
Well, let me ask you this question. I mean, speaking of economic policies, it might not work.
Uh-huh.
When you talk about voting for a libertarian as a kind of a protest vote, are you just interested in how one at this point successfully protests against the system, or are you also asking yourself, looking forward to future elections, is there a type of libertarian candidate who could assemble a coalition that could actually win?
You know, I hope so. I actually think that it's going to be very hard for the Libertarian Party to actually win for the reason it would be hard for any third party to win. So I think the end goal I have in mind isn't actually the Libertarian Party electing a president so much as the Libertarian Party getting 10% of the vote and then 15% and then 25%. And whatever that threshold is that you cross where the other two parties start to steal all of your good ideas, That's what I want to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that isn't to say that I wouldn't love it if, you know, like, I think I would prefer Gary Johnson, actually, the Libertarian candidate, to be president rather than Obama or Romney. And I think that if the election were between Gary Johnson and Barack Obama, I think that most Democrats would vote for Obama. I think most liberals and progressives would vote for Obama. I would argue that they should be voting for Gary Johnson, that he is socially liberal on all of the things that they care about, that his economic policies are going to redistribute money a little bit less than liberals like, but are also going to give money to corporations less, and that his national security policies and foreign policy would all be much better. The war on drugs would be much better.
Mm-hmm.
And that the policies that he actually would have control over would be much better, whereas the things that liberals and progressives wouldn't like so much, he would be subject to being checked by Congress. And I guess maybe a way to think about this is if you were living in a state where Rand Paul was running for Senate, would you vote for him? You know, he's a Tea Party Republican, basically on domestic issues, on fiscal issues. He's also one of the few voices, now that Russ Feingold is gone, that's standing up and saying, hey, maybe we shouldn't have indefinite detention. I'm going to try and block these things in the Senate. I'm going to try and sneak through amendments that prevent us from going to war with Iran. How does a guy like that come down, given your mix of beliefs?
Well, I'm actually very unlike the average voter and unlike the average progressive voter in that I put a lot of emphasis on foreign policy. So,
yeah.
If I thought voting for one of these people could really sway American policy in terms of foreign policy and civil liberties and national security policy, both in its foreign and domestic manifestations, I guess I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would be willing to give up something on the domestic economic policy front. I would, because I personally think the biggest peril America faces is these national security issues right now, in terms of the possibility of out and out catastrophe, you know. But at the same time, I think income inequality is reaching a point where that becomes an actual threat to the country as well. So it's a tough call. But I'm a much easier sale than you're going to make with progressives in general.
Yes, absolutely. I ask partly because this is another route, right, to getting these issues changed in a way that would make me less terrified.
Mm-hmm.
The Church Committee era and that post-Nixon Congress that really fought back against creeping executive power and against a lot of the things that the CIA was doing abroad is as unlikely as it seems today that Congress would stand up to the executive branch. There is precedent for it.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's only possible when you have a scandal like Watergate. I don't know. It's another route, and I do think, even though it's what I've been doing for most of this conversation, I think that a lot of libertarians make a mistake. A lot of people from every ideological point of view make a mistake by not realizing how important senators are.
Realizing how important what are?
Senators. In
yeah.
other words, one senator can do a whole yeah. lot if he is determined to do so, to block what a president is doing, to question, to have oversight. Russ Feingold during the Bush administration showed that. I think Rand Paul is showing it now.
Yeah.
And as little as he can ultimately do
That's
alone,
what
if there were four guys like him.
Explain to me. I'm not a student of the way the actual political system works. What is the dynamic by which Rand Paul manages to attach? I'm not sure if he wound up being successful. I mean, he was, but you alluded to this amendment. I guess it was in some sanctions legislation, or it was Iran-related legislation. And the amendment he added was that this should not be construed as validating war with Iran, basically, right? And
right, yes.
And what is the process by which a single senator, what was he threatening to do that got the attention of all the hawks who would rather that amendment have not been there?
Well, you know, I mean, I'd have to actually go back and look on paper to know all of the procedural things that a senator can do, from, you know, putting holds on things to actually trying to filibuster something. Being as marginalized as Rand Paul is now, what he can do is, you know, suggest these, he can sort of throw these procedural wrenches into things. He can suggest amendments, and he can get a lot of publicity for them and force, you know, for example, war with Iran right now, right, is not something that the public is very excited about. Maybe they would be on board with it if we had an Iraq war style public opinion offensive.
I think we've had one to some extent. I mean, there's been a pretty concerted effort to depict Iran as run by crazy people. If they had a nuke, would use it.
Well, nevertheless, Americans are at the moment, you know, public opinion polls indicate are not eager to go to war with Iran.
Yeah, I guess.
And I think that in the case of Iran, what Rand Paul is doing is basically saying, I see the way that Congress is preparing for the possibility of doing this. And right now, while public opinion is still sort of on our side, I want to draw attention to this, and I want to get people on record saying that, no, this thing we're doing isn't justification. And, you know, I think that Senator Paul would cite things like Libya, where Obama went to war in violation of the War Powers Resolution and never even got Congress to sign on. And he would say, that is evidence enough that even the smallest vote about Iran could be later misconstrued as Congress giving their imprimatur on war. Mm-hmm. And so he was trying to say, no, I'm going to try and stop that from happening. So I guess the maybe that doesn't answer your question very specifically.
No, it's fine. Don't. Yeah. It's not your obligation to educate me. I should have gotten a good education myself.
But in the big picture, I think that what he can do now, without four or five more guys who are like-minded, is to draw attention to the areas when public opinion isn't really on the side of the people who are pushing these sorts of policies. And he can say, wait a minute, I'm gonna force you to confront what you're actually doing. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to make it so that it's not just institutional inertia that is making all these things happen. Because especially with, there's always all this talk among conservatives about how the media has this liberal bias. In fact, the media has a bias to covering conflict.
Right.
And a bill could be absolutely awful for all sorts of reasons, absolutely terrible and worrisome and radical and without precedent. And as long as both parties are kind of going along with it, there's a good chance that it's not going to get all that much attention paid to it by the media. But if one senator is standing up and shouting his head off and saying this is terrible and radical, that's going to draw headlines, and that's going to make it so that the guy at the ACLU who works on this stuff gets a call from the New York Times and is able to inject a paragraph into that, and maybe that leads to an editorial. I think that's the way.
It's never going to make a difference. I mean, at the same time, with this Iran thing specifically, it is still the case that people, I don't think many people realize, we are drifting to war because of constraint, political constraints that the president perceives. There is not going to be some kind of good deal that comes out of this next round negotiation in Moscow, because the president feels that he's politically constrained from offering what it would take to the Iranians. And, you know, that's life.
Well, and the frustrating thing about it, right, is that in the same way that happened in the run-up to the Iraq War, there doesn't seem to be any way for the counter-narrative of doing this is dangerous to take hold, right? Even though you have people in Israeli intelligence, even though you have the RAND Corporation, even though you have all of these sort of independent sources saying actually attacking Iran could even make the nuclear problem worse in the long run. It could lead to all of these catastrophic consequences, right? And yet people don't, like, the fear campaign doesn't seem to work going the other direction for some reason. People don't seem to fear the consequences of what would happen if we do, you know, send our Air Force over and strike Iran. And I don't quite understand why that is, because it certainly scares me. I mean, I think it's bad policy. But it scares me that Iran would retaliate in various ways. It scares me that our people abroad are going to get killed. It scares me that they have sleeper agents in the United States that are going to retaliate. And I don't see why that seems to scare people less viscerally than the idea that Iran could eventually get a nuclear weapon that, for the foreseeable future, could not target the United States, even if they had a nuclear weapon.
No, I mean, a lot of the actual rhetoric is about them using a nuclear weapon on Israel, and that concerns a lot of people. I think that is hugely overblown as well. But that is, to people, a more tangible, you know, visceral kind of scenario than this vague blowback that's going to come because of a war far away. I don't know. It's also the case that this isn't like Iraq in the sense that, okay, we're slowly mounting this offensive and there's all this time to reflect on it, you know.
Right.
If this happens, it's going to happen fast. Either Israel's going to strike and we're going to be drawn in, or we're going to strike and the president is not going to say a week in advance, we're going to strike. I mean, if it happens, I don't think it's going to be – if America strikes, I don't think it's going to be Obama in this term. Could be Israel not long before the election, but it would more likely be, well, Romney. But but it's not a – there isn't going to be the okay. – I don't think people are taking – even now, that's seriously the prospect of war with Iran. It is a drift, and people don't understand it.
In your personal opinion, you know, we found out in recent days that the Obama administration, as well as the Bush administration, I guess, were using basically cyber warfare against Iran, you know, with the Stuxnet virus. Where do you draw the line, you personally, with – Like, at what point should a president have to get a declaration of war?
Well, that's an interesting question, you know, because Obama had himself issued a report about a year ago in which we basically said, if someone attacks us with cyber weapons, that is tantamount to an act of war. In other words, we will consider it a threat just like any other threat, and we will respond with military force if necessary, okay? Well, if that's the case, if it's really an act of war, then in theory, you'd think that it's not something that a president should be able to do casually, which he did, you know?
Right.
I'm very concerned. I mean, I think this is, you know, we're entering a new era where it may be that in principle you could establish a kind of a global norm that nation states don't do this, and it could maybe be accompanied by a treaty that is not 100% effective but is effective enough to minimize this kind of stuff. And maybe that's a really, really, really important thing to happen because if nation states are developing these things, they may get in the wrong hands and so on. So I'm concerned. I haven't totally thought it through. I don't have a clear idea of how important it is, but it bothers me that, of course, almost no one's talking about it. And because Iran has been depicted as this grave threat to national security, it's like there's nothing you can do to Iran that will upset people, apparently. You assassinate their civilians, and that's okay. You sabotage, you know, you blow things up. That's okay. You do this cyber attack. That's okay, you know.
Right. In fact, you have American politicians who are working on behalf of an organization that is officially declared a terrorist organization by the United States
government. Yeah, the MEK. Right.
And taking money from them. And it's... despite the bogeyman status
not
of the
only
word
that,
terrorist,
not only that,
even that,
but oh well, I don't want to get off on a hobby horse. But I mean, I will say, to get back to your original question, I mean, I find this stuff so frustrating that I have this impulse. I mean, third party protest votes, I don't know, but every once in a while, I am seized by the impulse to just take it to the streets. You know, I mean, I mean, get up on a soapbox and start screaming or something, you know, because it just seems to me these forces are so stubborn, the institutional forces that stand in the way of what I would consider enlightened policy, and I could be wrong, of course, but that it just, you just think you're going to have to make a ruckus. And it's kind of unfortunate that, the Occupy ruckus, I mean, parts of what that was about I sympathize with. I think income inequality is a big problem. But they were like against having goals. That's not the way I would do it, you know. I would have goals.
Yeah, I agree with that. So how would you feel if hypothetically Mitt Romney wins the election and President Obama, or I guess ex-President Obama, goes with his family on vacation, and they're, you know, lying on the beach in southern Spain, and, you know, along comes a particularly zealous guy from, you know, some international court, some European court. You know, someone comes and tries to arrest Obama and throw him in jail and try him for war crimes.
From an international court? Yeah. How would I feel?
Yeah.
Oh, I haven't thought that one through. I mean, as an abstract matter, I'm not, you know, the International Criminal Court is a potentially valuable thing. We, of course, have not signed on to it. I don't know what legal implications that would have. Are you imagining that something under the auspices of the ICC or...
I didn't specify it, and I don't know
what the legalism of that is. I am not in favor of whatever happened. Did it happen with some Argentinian or something? Was in Spain, and I'm not in favor of individual national governments being able to arrest citizens of other countries for violations of international law and prosecuting them themselves. I am a global governance person, but I don't consider that an actual form of global governance.
Right.
I consider that almost the opposite, even though it's being done in the name of international law. But
yeah.
So I don't know if that answers your question. But
yeah, one thing that I wrestle with is, you know, it seems to me that the Obama administration should not have granted the immunity that it has to the Bush administration for the various things that it did.
Yeah.
And I think that the Obama administration itself is committing very worrisome crimes, and that the fact that every president knows that he is never going to be held legally accountable for breaking the law is tremendously problematic.
Yeah.
And so on the one hand, part of me wants a president to be prosecuted. I would prefer that they be prosecuted in the United States for breaking laws. On the other hand, I am realistic enough to understand that if that ever happens, the fact that both parties have been doing this for so long, any prosecution is going to have a legitimacy problem,
mm-hmm.
and in fact might be being used
right.
for purely partisan purposes. You know, so and even that is complicated because sometimes things done for partisan purposes, you know, sometimes partisanship is the mechanism by which other people on the other team are held accountable, right? So
it's happened.
I don't know. I have very mixed feelings about it, and I fear that there would be some sort of like chaos or crisis of legitimacy if a prosecution ever happened. At the same time, I fear these catastrophic consequences if it continues to be the case that presidents can just do anything and never worry about being held accountable.
Yeah, that is a tough one. I hadn't done that thought experiment before.
Well, why don't we, before we end, let's talk a little bit about Facebook, which hopefully we can end on a slightly less depressing note. Unless you're Mark Zuckerberg, because you wrote recently that you think that Facebook is going to, be strong in the long run because it has this very salutary network effect, that is, in the internet age, literally a network effect, and that it's going to be very hard for anyone to come along and supplant them.
Yeah, the idea, network effect, positive network externalities, meaning that the more people who are on the network, the more valuable it is to be on the network. The key manifestation of that is that whenever anybody starts a rival, like Google+, it's just relatively unattractive, even if it's better done, because what you're on Facebook for is the fact that everyone else is on there. So anyone you want to network with is on there, and it's just very hard for a startup to replicate that key attractive feature. That's my argument about the what insulates Facebook from competition. Yeah.
Right. So I want to make a counter argument. Certainly, I will grant that it could be the case that Facebook is around and healthy for a long time. At the same time, when I think back on my lifetime, I think back to when I was in junior high school, and everyone in my class in 5th and 6th and 7th grade spent a ton of time talking to one another on the phone at night. You would call the girl you liked. You would call your friends for help with homework. In the time before you could drive and it was after dark and you weren't allowed to be out late, there was this time between when you had to be home and when you had to go to bed, and the phone was the natural way for kids to communicate, right? And of course, it was the way that all sorts of other people communicated, all sorts of adults communicated. In a very short amount of time, we've had this very unexpected thing happen where people just don't use the phone anymore. Despite you and I talking on it now, I have very little need for even a data plan on my cell phone. Almost all of my peers communicate by text if we're going to go out and meet for dinner or whatever. And I understand that this is even more pervasive among young people today, that they're texting like mad and not talking on the phone much at all.
Right. You do have a need for a data plan. You don't have a need for the phone part of the plan.
Right, exactly. If it wasn't for the fact that maybe I would have to get a work phone call occasionally,
right,
I could just persist completely on Skype. The only point I want to make is that the way that people communicate lately has been changing very quickly, and I imagine that it's going to continue to change very quickly, and I think that one of the ways it's going to change, I think that young people are going to start to associate Facebook with their parents, with this official place where everything you do is very public.
Mm-hmm.
I think Facebook isn't going to go away, but I think maybe it's going to evolve into something that is almost like almost like a variation on a resume. It's going to be something where you share some information about yourself, but probably the way you communicate with your friends, I don't know, maybe it's going to be text messages, maybe it's going to be Twitter direct messages, probably it's going to be something that we can't even imagine, right? And so we're going to have these things coexisting, right? Mm-hmm. The big Facebook network and then all of these little things.
Right.
And the argument that I want to make is that it's very easy for any of those little things to grow into a bigger thing over time. Because you mentioned Google Plus and how it's very hard for them to challenge Facebook, right?
Right.
But actually the problem with Google Plus wasn't that Facebook had a big network and no one wanted to join Google Plus. The problem with Google Plus was that everybody joined it. Joining it was as easy as clicking a button. No one used it because they don't like it. They don't like it as a platform. I think the network effect that you're talking about is diminished by the fact that it's very easy to click a couple of buttons and, you know, you click import all contacts and suddenly you have your whole social network replicated on a different platform. And that seems very easy to me.
Well, Facebook has been pretty vigilant about keeping people from downloading the stuff from Facebook. I mean,
right, but you still have everyone in your email contacts.
Yeah, you do. I would say that, well, just a couple of things. I mean, first of all, as for the Google Plus case, it's true that, you know, people went there and maybe didn't like the interface. That's almost inherent in changing, though. New interfaces are intrinsically difficult, and anyone with a new interface is going to face that problem. The fact is, Google Plus had some features that were better than Facebook. And Facebook said, well, we'll just steal them, and then people will have the familiarity of the Facebook interface plus the new features. And I think Facebook's going to be in position to do that time and time again. Now, the example of phones, kind of phone calls dying as the fundamental networking device, that's true, but I mean, that's kind of a different scenario. I'm talking about somebody coming up with something that is technologically comparable to Facebook, and whether they can or cannot succeed. That's a different question from whether some wholly new technology will supersede the Facebook technology. That's a slightly different scenario.
Yeah, that's true.
And I would say that, you know, Facebook is working hard to head that off. I think only today, who is it, Sean Fanning and the other Sean, the two guys who did Napster, announced that this startup they've been working on is now ready to go, and it's going to be a video conferencing service on Facebook. That, you know, video chat, kind of like Google Hangouts or something. So,
right, yeah.
I look, you know, anything could happen. But I think another way to think about it is I think what Facebook is trying, I mean, you know, it would be very surprising, right, if somebody came up at this point with a form of communication that was somehow outside of the internet, right? I mean, okay, there could be new new ways of communicating, but it would be pretty shocking if it wasn't based on the internet, right? What I'm suggesting is that Facebook aspires to get to that point itself, right? That people are spending so much time on it, doing so many things, that it's like the internet to them. And any new form of anything can be instantiated in it. They may be wrong, but they're working on it.
Yeah,
one question
that'll be interesting to me is, will Facebook remain as popular once the novelty is gone?
Well, see, I think happened. I think, and it's still here. And I mean, I think a big question is how fundamental is the thing that, say, Facebook provides? You know, like my daughter, the one who's in high school, came back. You know, she missed the prom, which she wasn't too upset about, because there was some writing program that she was admitted to, and this thing at Breadloaf in Vermont, and so she went and did that instead. When she came back, the first thing she did was check Facebook as a way of finding out kind of how the prom had gone, you know?
Yeah.
And I just asked, I just thought, that's a pretty fundamental thing that just happened, you know? I mean, it's like, it's never going to be the case that a teenager who misses something like that doesn't come back and want to be caught up on it in a very efficient way. And so right now, Facebook is doing something pretty fundamental. And so is it possible to imagine, like, those kinds of services being done by somebody else who can really attract a migration from Facebook? And I'm not having an easy time imagining that, but maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I don't know. The thing that keeps me on Facebook, and it actually isn't something that I use a ton, but the thing that keeps me from just severing my account is that I, you know, grew up with people in these various places. When I was in high school, when I was in college, when I was living abroad, I grew up with these people, and Facebook allows me to contact them in a way that is very easy.
Right.
And that still seems novel to me, that anyone from anyone, any time in my life, basically, I can reach out to them. And, you know, I could probably find them on email. I could find some of them on Twitter. I could find – pretty much I could find all of them on some other platform. But they're on Facebook. And you're right that there is that network effect. I wonder how things would be different if I had grown up with Facebook and suddenly – it isn't – my default is like interacting with people in the online world, and there isn't anyone that I stopped – so for me, there are people who I kept in touch with less than I would have had there been different technology.
Right.
People who are young today won't have that same effect because technology will be there for them to communicate with people.
Yeah.
And I imagine that, like me, many friendships will fall away, some will remain, and I wonder if they'll have that same impulse at some point to reach out to people they haven't talked to in years, because they could have all along, right? Just like I could have called these people on the phone all along. Technology suddenly made it easier to do it, and so I did it, and I'm reluctant to give that up. But I think there's a different dynamic, and I guess it's obviously totally unclear how it'll play out. But I do think that the second Facebook generation will be different than the first.
Yeah, well, I think one scenario that could be bad for Facebook that you kind of hinted on earlier is, you know, I think everyone probably has a Facebook friend they'd just as soon not have. And for a lot of kids, it's their parents, you know. And it may you can imagine maybe the kids just saying, hey, there's this generic thing, whether it's Google Plus or whatever else it is. Let's just not mention it to our parents. Let's start, you know, that we'll feel freer to communicate there. You can imagine something like that growing with a younger generation. But I should say, you know, I personally really don't use Facebook. I'm not an extrovert. I think it's weird that you send stuff out there and you're not even sure who's seeing it.
But you post things on the internet for a living.
Well, I know, but I really don't do Facebook much, and I'm doing Twitter as a professional necessity now. I only started about five months ago, but I really think Twitter is a professional necessity in a way that Facebook is. I mean, I've come to believe that about Twitter over the last 5 months. And look, you as long as you're doing Twitter, you probably might as well use Facebook. One of the things we've gone on a while, but one thing that's weird about Facebook for people like you and me maybe is that our friends are actually an amalgam of people we actually know on the one hand and people who have maybe read our stuff and friended us and we friend them back. So it's an even stranger feeling than I think it would be for me to just use real regular Facebook where you actually have actually at least met the people that are your friends, you know. And I think that's one reason, you know, Steve Call got a fair amount of attention when he recently quit Facebook. I don't know if you read his piece. But he's in that boat, and I think he said he was. He has thousands of so-called friends. Most of them are actually his fans. And it's it becomes a weird hybrid thing. I think it may be that if I were not a journalist, oddly, Facebook would actually be something I'd want to do. I don't know.
Yeah, I can understand that. You know, another interesting thing about Facebook is that, at least in my experience, when I think of my parents and my parents' friends, the men and the women, my mom and my dad, to take one example, have different styles of keeping in touch with their friends over the years. And of course, you know, there's nothing that's true about all men or all women. But in general, my mom and her female friends have kept in touch with their friends in a way that's relatively similar to each other compared to their husbands and how they've kept in touch with their friends.
My wife is all over Facebook. I mean, there's a stereotype developing that Twitter is for guys and Facebook is for, you know, and that can't be nearly true, but it's a.
Right. Well, yeah, I was going to say, I actually wasn't aware of that, but it does seem interesting that insofar as everyone is on Facebook, there's this sense in which, the genders are communicating with friends more similarly to one another, maybe than they once did. But maybe this also points us to a future where there is a gender-based split and where there are some social networks that are geared toward different kinds of communication
and that have
different gender breakdowns as a result.
I mean, that's interesting. I mean, because I think the idea behind the stereotype you were describing is that males are a little more instrumentally focused in their communications or something, or more instrumental or something. And when you think about it, Facebook is not that. You know, it's not for focused highly instrumental communication. But I don't know.
We'll talk about it again in 5 years and see who's right.
We will see who's right. I mean, I think Facebook will be around and strong. There's a separate question of whether it can monetize. I think the answer is probably yes, but monetize enough to justify a high stock price. But that's certainly something we don't have time to get into.
Yeah, agreed.
So, well, listen,
all right.
I've enjoyed my time on the Friedersdorf Show.
Should I be
flattered that I kept
time.
You on for more than an hour?
I think so, yes.
Some guests don't.
You should be. I've had a good time on the whole Bob Wright Blogging Hence platform, so I thank you for it, and hopefully we'll do it again sometime.
I hope so. All thank
right.
you, Connor.